You're listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network.
Hey guys, this is Dennis Kang. Hey,
this is Mr. Cripples, a.k.a. the Cat Smasher.
Hey, this is John the Natural Alessio.
Hey, this is Rashad Evans.
Hey guys, this is the Big Frog, Jeff Curran.
Hey, this is Mac Danzig.
Hey guys, this is Jason the Athlete McDonald.
Hi, this is Ivan Salvage.
Hey everybody, this is Joe Peltier, Jay Dirksen.
Hey, it's Mark Machine Hopping here.
Hey everybody, you are listening to the world's most handsome fighter on the planet. Yes, this is El Guapo, and you are listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio with Kelsey Mowat.
Thank you for tuning in to yet another edition of Full Contact Fighter Radio. We're heading into an extremely busy time, and to help me work through all these fantastic events coming up, Mr. Brendan Lear. Brendan, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Kels. How are you?
I can't complain. We got an interesting show today. We've got Nick Thompson coming on the show. He's going to be fighting Eddie Alvarez at the upcoming Bodog fight. Pay-per-view April 14th in St. Petersburg, Russia, one of the many events that are going on in the month of April.
Would he be the GOAT?
He is the GOAT. He's the GOAT. So people can look forward to, you know, maybe I'll ask him a little bit about if people can look forward to the GOAT's beard again.
Was he munching on a tin can while you were doing the interview?
Yeah, you know, it's so true, eh? Whenever there's a GOAT, that's always what they're drawn with. Because mm-hmm. What's the idea? I mean, you're a farmer, so you explain to us urbanites.
Yes, Kelsey. Well, none of my many goats have ever eaten tin cans, but I believe the goat is such a hardy animal. The belief is that they'll eat anything. So,
really?
Goats. Yeah. Have you ever been nibbled by a goat?
I have. I think I've patted a couple goats. I think. Yeah.
They'll nibble the crap out of you.
It's interesting that you'd say that because I think you've been referred to in the same fashion. You'll eat anything.
Well, I have eaten many things.
Right.
But I try not to.
Yeah, that's going to be a good fight, though, getting back to the GOAT and Eddie Alvarez. Got to see both those guys fight live when I was at Bodog Fights' first pay-per-view here in Vancouver last year, and I got to talk to both the fighters after the show a little bit. And you know, Eddie Alvarez is a guy that a lot of people are watching. A lot of people are thinking he could be the next big thing at the welterweight division. He's got a lot of hype behind him in the East. And then Nick Thompson's a good veteran guy. He's been in the ring against some notable opponents. He's a UFC veteran. It's going to be a great fight. And then as well, you've got your own kind of thing going on this show, Brendan, a first. This is a historical FCF radio. You're going to be doing your own interview. Sam Sheridan, tell us a little bit about that. He wrote a book.
A solo interview, Kelsey.
Yes.
That was very frightening. Sam Sheridan, has written a marvelous new book. Really not the book is called A Fighter's Heart, and it's Sheridan's journey doing basically a whole bunch of training that reads almost like an MMA fantasy camp. So he started off after graduating from university and went and trained at Fairtex the olden days, and then some interesting tales about that, and fought a professional Muay Thai fight, and then went off, signed this book deal, and went off to train with Miletic's camp for a number of months, and then made his way down to Brazil and trained with the top team, and has basically trained all over the world, and sort of summarized his experiences and his thoughts in a very nice little book, very well written, very thoughtful, but also very very interesting in a sort of anecdotal way. A lot of interesting stories about training in Thailand and in Brazil, and of course with Pat Miletic.
Yeah, I'd like to check it out. I've read a couple MMA books, but more so from the side of writing recaps of fights and talking about the evolution of the sport as a whole, rather than one man's kind of trip into training and meeting up with various professional fighters. It does sound interesting, and I think he was on The Daily Show recently, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Yeah,
he was on The Daily Show, and it was a kind of a disappointment for me because I thought he'd be better on Colbert. Maybe throwing down with him, but
yeah.
But Jon Stewart will have to do. No, the book's been fairly well received all over the place, and it got a good push. And I think the interesting thing about the book is that it's not only an MMA book, but I think anyone is really interested in martial arts or fighting in general. I forgot as well. He trained with Andre Ward in his camp. He was an Olympic gold medalist and as a professional boxer. I think he has a 10-0 record now. So he trained boxing as well too. So you know, anything really you're interested in combative sports, he's dabbled in and has some very interesting reflections on. And he's also a very articulate and thoughtful guy himself. So yeah, no, it's an excellent book. It was one of those books where you just can't put it down, especially myself. I piled through it in a couple nights.
Well, and it's a long interview. You guys spoke for quite some time, so just letting the listeners know that it's split into two parts. Tonight, this edition will have the first part. It's about 25, 30 minutes, and then the second show this week will feature the second interview with Sam Sheridan, the conclusion of that interview. So people can stay tuned for that. Nick Thompson's up next. You're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
When you think mixed martial arts, there's only one name that instills fear. Fedor Emelianenko. Watch two MMA legends when the number one ranked heavyweight fighter Fedor Emelianenko takes on one of the top pound-for-pound fighters in the world. In Bodog Fight, Fedor Emelianenko versus Matt Lindley. Plus see Fedor's brother Alexander Emelianenko battle Eric Pele. And more Saturday, April 14th, only on pay-per-view. Visit BodogFight.com/PPV for details.
You don't have to be a champion to dress like one. With the Full Contact Fighter Shop, we have all the MMA gear that you see so many of your favorite professional fighters wearing. NHB Extreme Fight shorts, camouflage board shorts, corduroy and camo hats, hooded sweatshirts, to the classic FCF t-shirts, Full Contact Fighter clothing is the number one mixed martial arts brand that any MMA fan must have. Now open is the FCF sticker and banner shop. We have all your favorite IFL team clothing, plus a great assortment of low-priced Pride and MMA DVDs are now all available at the FCF shop. To check it out, head to www.fcfighter.com, pick up the latest edition of the FCF paper, or call 516-676-0033. That number, again, 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter, the undefeated, no-holds-barred new source of the world. Joining Full Contact Fighter Radio now is the GOAT, Mr. Nick Thompson, who's going to be taking on Eddie Alvarez on the upcoming Bodog Fight pay-per-view April 14th from St. Petersburg, Russia. Nick, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing real well, thanks.
My first question for you, Nick, is in regards to heading overseas, etc. When are you heading out? How far in advance are you going to try to get there? And do you think as far as time change, is that going to affect you at all? Or are you going to get there plenty in advance?
We leave on the 9th. The fight is the 14th, so I'll have 5 days out there to kind of adjust. And actually, I'll start switching over my schedule now. I got to figure out the time difference, but I'm assuming, I think it's like 12 hours difference, so I'll be fighting on a completely opposite schedule, so I'll start training real early in the morning as opposed to training at night like I normally do.
Yeah. And before we get into your specific fight against Eddie, what's your general sense been as far as the pre-fight hype to this card? Fedor Emelianenko versus Matt Lindley, your fight with Eddie Alvarez catching some attention. Alexander Emelianenko versus Eric Pele. You get the sense compared to the first Bodog fight pay-per-view, which you also fought on, that this event's going to be a bit bigger, a little more people are going to watch?
Yeah, I think anytime you get someone like Fedor, who's clearly number one in the world, and Matt Lindland, who's in my opinion the number one 85er in the world, that's going to draw some attention. That's going to do nothing but good things for me being on the main card with them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into it then with talking about Eddie Alvarez. I guess a lot of people would think of Eddie as one of the more notable up and coming welterweights in the States. It's starting to catch a little bit of attention around the MMA community. And then you got yourself a veteran guy, very impressive record, 30-9. What do you think about Eddie Alvarez as a fighter, and what do you need to do to beat him, Nick?
I've been really impressed with Eddie. His hands are phenomenal. I haven't seen him on the ground only because nobody's been able to take him down. He's, as you mentioned, 9-0 and has knocked everybody out and only gone to the second round once. And some of those wins include guys like Derek Noble and Aaron Riley, and knocking them out is no easy feat. So I've been very impressed with Eddie. That being said, I really like the matchup for myself. I'm bigger, stronger. I think I'm more well-rounded than Eddie is.
So in talking about his hands that way, are you going to look to take the fight to the ground, or are you comfortable trying to hang out with him up there for a little bit?
I'll stay with him for a while. I've stood with some of the best strikers at 170. You know, I've stood with Chris Wilson and guys like that who I think are definitely different styles, but very, very good strikers just like Eddie. So I'm willing to stand and trade with him, and I guess I'd rather lose a fight where we're standing up and trading than take him down and try and lay and pray on him.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Derek Noble, one of the guys that Eddie has beaten. We had Eddie on the program, I guess it was last week or the week before, and I asked him about his experience advantage coming up against his opponent, Diego Gonzalez, and he actually referred to the Eddie Alvarez fight as a reason that maybe he looked at Eddie's record, and he hadn't fought as many big-name guys as Derek had, and he's never going to take an opponent lightly based on that. How about for yourself, Nick? Do you look at it that way as well, or do you also factor in the factor that you've got way more fights than him. You've got 40 fights and that you've got more ring experience than him.
I take that into account in assessing what my strengths are in the fight. For example, I think the later this fight goes, the better off I am, just because of that experience. And so I definitely take that into account into making a game plan. But as far as underestimating him, certainly not. I mean, he's been devastating the way he's done to people. And I'm fighting for the Bulldog fight title of the world. I mean, it's definitely not a fight I'm going to take lightly.
Yeah. For people who maybe don't know a lot about your usual training camp, tell us a little bit about who you're training with for this fight and how's that been going.
I'm at Minnesota Martial Arts Academy with UFC 155-pound champion Sean Sherk. We've also got Brock Larson in there, who's a fellow 170-pounder who's, I think, 18-1 now after just winning the WEC against Eric Apple. And we've also got Brock Lesnar in there. So we've got a real good camp, guys, real strong wrestlers. And we've also got Nat McIntyre, who's the U.S. Muay Thai champion at 135. So we've got great strikers in there, too. And working with those guys is just great. It's a real, real good team atmosphere. You know, for example, Nat McIntyre even passed up on a real big Muay Thai fight to help me train for this fight. So when you got guys making sacrifices for the team like that, it's just a great camp to be a part of.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit about Brock Lesnar, but we'll get into that in a minute once we're done talking about your career more specifically. You mentioned the win over Chris Wilson. You had a big win over Ansar Chalangov at the first Bodog pay-per-view. What has this done for you, this opportunity with Bodog fight? And do you feel that maybe you were left off the wider radar map of MMA for at least a year, Nick, and maybe unjustifiably so?
I think it was more probably by choice. In fact, right before I signed with Bodog, the UFC called me up to fight Nate Marquardt and actually just Josh Koscheck as well. But I think Bodog fight was just a better fit for me at that time. They seemed to be more willing to accommodate my school schedule as far as giving me advance notice and just things like that, where I've been really, really happy working with Bodog. I think I'm definitely getting a little less attention than I would if I were in the UFC, but in the end, I'm not doing this for attention. I'm doing this to pay my mortgage and because I like fighting. So Bulldog fight's been just great fighting for them.
And you mentioned school. Tell us a little bit about what else you do in your life. You're not a full-time fighter.
I am currently a law student at 2L, which is the second year at the University of Minnesota. And so I go to school during the morning, train during the afternoon, and study at night. That's about all I do. I don't really have time for anything else.
And there's a couple of guys in Bodog fight that have similar stories to you. I mean, Derek Noble, I think, is finishing up his MBA. You got Michael Patty, who works as a, I think, in real estate. He's like a real estate consultant. The guys that work full time and then also train. Do you find, Nick, and a lot of these guys have found this, that people still sometimes have preconceived notions about what kind of person you are if you tell them you're an MMA fighter, or some of those stereotypes changing as the sport evolves and gets bigger?
I think it's definitely starting to change, especially given the dominance of wrestlers who traditionally are college athletes, so they've got degrees. I think when people first hear you're fighting, they kind of get that assumption that, you know, you're some guy who goes out to the bar and picks fights. But the more and more it's been on TV, I think people are understanding that, you know, we're professional athletes. Most of us went to college, and even if we didn't, we're not people that are picking fights in bars. You know, we're people that are training and take our jobs very seriously.
Well, you mentioned the UFC and how Bodog fight seemed to be a better fit for you. You went 1-1 in the UFC. And I know people, particularly in Minnesota, were quite excited when you made it to the UFC, especially after your first win. Do you foresee being back in that organization at all, especially with news in regards to Pride, or are you happy in Bodog fight, and do you see Bodog fight as being a viable competitor to the new Zuffa Pride organization?
I'm happy with Bodog. I'm fighting for them. If I end my career there, that's great. As long as they're willing to bring in top competition, which obviously with Lin Lin coming in, Fedor coming in, Shields coming in, it seems like they're willing to do that. As long as they do that, I'm happy to finish my career with Bodog. That being said, I would never rule going back to the UFC out. UFC's right now the premier organization, and it's where all the top fighters are. And, you know, at some point, if Bodog for some reason can't bring the George St. Pierre's to them, then I'm going to want to go there and fight those guys so I can be number one.
Yeah.
That being said, obviously, Bodog seems to be willing to try and go out and get those guys, so I think they're a viable competitor, and we'll see in the next couple of years if we'll see some more guys like Win Win and Fedor coming over.
You talked about your training camp, and of course, Brock Larson, a big win over Eric Apple recently in the WEC. Brock Lesnar, you also mentioned, and that this is a guy who's capturing a lot of headlines in the MMA community. Try to give us an insight into his abilities, Nick, and is it more than, I think some people sort of assume that this is almost like a freak show thing that K1 Heroes is trying to do, but Brock Lesnar is an accomplished wrestler. Try to give us a little bit of insight into his abilities and what you think he might be able to do in the MMA world.
I sincerely believe Lesnar is going to be the world champion heavyweight in the next couple of years. I think right now he's in the top 10, if not top 5.
Wow.
And, you know, I think when he first came in, I kind of had the same assumption everybody else did, that, you know, he was kind of just going to come in and say, oh, well, I wrestled for the University of Minnesota. I'm a national champ. I'm just going to do, you know, things my way. And we've seen a lot of wrestlers have done that and not been very successful, especially as the game's kind of evolved. But his attitude was the complete opposite. He came in and said, listen, you guys know what you're doing. Teach me. And he's someone that's willing to learn like that, that already has the wrestling background, and on top of that is a phenomenal athlete, I think is a rare find. He's incredibly quick for a big guy. I remember sparring with him the first time we sparred. I wasn't that worried about it because, well, one, he'd never boxed before. And most heavyweights, you know, they hit hard, but they're slow.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, I'll just kind of jab and move with them, and it turns out he jabs faster than I do. So, you know, you add that to his takedowns and the fact that he's willing to learn submissions, and we got guys that are good teachers, and he's going to be a very dangerous guy for anybody to fight.
And then Sean Sherk, there's been no official confirmation from the UFC yet, or at least that I've seen or read, as far as to when he'll be fighting next and whether or not it will be Hermes Franca. But tell us a little bit about Sean and his situation right now, and when do you get the sense that he's going to be back in the ring defending his title?
Well, Sean went into the Kenny Florian fight with a torn labrum, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is, some tendon that attached his shoulder to his collarbone, so he couldn't lift his shoulder in that fight. If you ever watch the fight again, you'll notice he was only throwing hooks, not a single right hand.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to have surgery after the Florian fight, and he is back training now, and he's about 100%. Looks real good in the gym. He's already back beating up on me pretty good. And we're hearing that it's just like everybody else, and he's fighting Franca in either late June or early July, I believe.
You know, with Sean Sherk, when he won the UFC lightweight championship, it was an interesting thing to see how rankings would be reflected. You know, there's a couple sites that do rankings. Full Contact Fighter, we do a system of rankings as well. And it seemed like there was kind of a debate, whether it was on MMA forums or wherever you might see it, in regards to his place in the lightweight division. And, of course, you had some people saying he's only fought once at 155. He has to work his way up in the lightweight division. Then you had other people like myself, I'll admit, that said, look, at 155, if the guy only lost twice at 170, he's going to be an extremely hard person to beat at 155. And now with the news, you know, people saw Takanori Gomi lose for the second time in just over a year. Your thoughts, Nick? I mean, I know you're going to be partially biased because you train with the man, but where do you see Sean ranking in the world, and what kind of fighter is it going to need to be to beat Sean at 155?
I guess as far as the rankings, it depends. I think there's two different ways to rank things. You can either rank, you know, on potential who would beat who if they fought. I think in that kind of ranking, Sean's clearly number one, even though he's only had one fight there. The way he's demonstrated himself at 70 and the fact that 155 is not a big cut really makes him a dominating force. I think the guys that are not ranking him, you know, in the top two or three are ranking people on what they have done, and he hasn't fought anybody, so if you want to rank him in the top 10 or whatever, fine, so be it. The fact is, you put him up against anybody at 155, he'll more than likely beat him. There are a few guys I think that would give him a tough time. Obviously, BJ Penn is going to give anybody in the world, just about anyway, a tough time.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody like that that can, you know, maybe an Aoki who can maybe negate Sean's wrestling a little bit, but he's just so well-rounded, it's tough. You know, I think against Diaz, he proved that if he can't take you down, he'll trade hands with you. He's got excellent jiu-jitsu. I think I'd put him against any black belt in the world as far as his grappling ability, and obviously his wrestling experience is phenomenal. So I really don't see him letting go of the 55 title anytime soon.
I always like to get fighters' thoughts on upcoming fights, in particular if it is in their same weight division. And, of course, April 7th is going to be Matt Serra versus George St. Pierre. And we've had both those guys on the show, and it seems like there's not a lot of hype behind this fight. I mean, there's no rivalry in the sense with GSP and Hughes, and even though there's some people who are looking forward to it, others maybe are perhaps looking past Matt Serra a little bit. What's your thought on this upcoming fight, Nick? Do you think the UFC and maybe fans alike are gearing up too much, looking ahead towards a Matt Hughes GSP 3 and not giving Serra the credit he deserves?
You know, I'm probably the wrong guy to ask because I'm terrible at picking fighters. I thought Couture had no chance over Sylvia.
Yeah.
I thought Trigg was going to kill Waller. So I'm probably not the best guy to ask. But I'm actually a little more excited for this fight than I think most people are. When I was getting ready to fight Carl, I watched Sarah's fight with Carl, and I've also watched his other fights. And he's a little bit undersized, but he's slick. I don't see St. Pierre submitting him. He's pretty good at avoiding the ground and pound, so I don't know if Serra can win this fight, but I think it's going to be a lot better fight than people think. He's a hard guy to hold down. He's athletic. He'll move. And I think whereas, you know, Hughes is going to try and out-wrestle St. Pierre, which is going to be tough, I don't think Serra's really going to do that. Serra's going to be able to go to wherever St. Pierre wants to take him, which I think makes it a harder fight for St. Pierre.
Yeah. Well, I know you don't necessarily have like a good insight into George St. Pierre, but you know from talking to him a couple times and hearing others' thoughts on GSP, I think the one thing that he's got going for him, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, is that it seems like he's the kind of fighter, at least still at this point in his career, where his ego is not going to get the better of him, that he's not going to take time off, that he's not going to take it easy preparing for Serra. Is that your sense as well, or do you think that any fighter can become guilty of that if they rise to a certain level of notoriety and fame?
He's with a pretty good training camp. I think that's one of the keys to keeping that from happening. I think a lot of the guys you see that kind of let the belt, fill the ego and they stop training are guys that are not in good camps. He's in a camp where he's going to have guys push him day in and day out. So that if he's not training, he'll realize long before the fight, hey, I need to change something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I can't speak to his attitude. I don't know him real well, but I just think the fact that he's with a good camp is going to make it all the more easier to focus on the fight. And if he's not concentrating, he's going to know in training that, hey, I'm getting beat. What's going on here?
Yeah. Well, and there's another great welterweight fight coming up, and I think it's one of the fights that I'm most excited about the many that are going to happen in April. April is a crazy, crazy month. And that is Josh Koscheck versus Diego Sanchez. This fight has all the makings, I think, of a classic in the sense that it could really turn out to be a very close competitive fight, I think. What are your thoughts on it, Nick?
I'm really excited to see that fight. It's probably, I agree with you as far as being one of the top fights I've been wanting to see probably all year. I would have maybe liked to see Diego go against the Hughes or somebody, but other than that, these are the top two young talents in the division who I think are, I mean, really the future of the division. You talk about St. Pierre, Koscheck, and Diego are probably the three guys that are going to be fighting for that belt for the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
They obviously fought on the show, but Koscheck only had one or two fights at that point and really hadn't trained any submissions. I personally think that Koscheck may take this fight. He's got Diego's game plan is to wrestle, as we've seen. He knocked out Riggs, but other than that, really he's looking to take people down, and Koscheck is better at Diego's game than Diego is. That's going to present a real problem for him. The only edge Diego really has is that he never stops moving. And so maybe he can out-scramble Koscheck, but out-scrambling a guy that won D1 Nationals is going to be a tough feat. So I would look for Koscheck to take a decision, especially since it's only a three-round fight.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you had to say. I think the Alessio fight, to me, really sort of reflected the fact that Diego, if he goes up against a good wrestler, that he's going to have a lot of problems taking someone down. And I think his stand-up, I think that this fight could really be determined by the stand-up, depending on how much Diego and Josh Koscheck have both evolved. Neither one of them has traditionally been known as great stand-up fighters, but Koscheck's shown some improvement, as well as you mentioned, Sanchez knocked out Riggs. So I think we could see the fight determined by the stand-up, just simply for the fact that Diego might not be able to get Josh down, and Josh might want to keep it standing.
Yeah, I really think that's going to be a big key. It's just that I think Koscheck's going to be able to decide where he wants the fight to take place. And when you got two guys that are as talented as those guys, that's a huge asset to have. I think if you look at pretty much the champions every other weight, they're able to do that same thing. Both the Liddells and Coutures are all able to dictate where the fight's going to go. And when you're fighting two good guys, I think that's just very important. So I really think Koscheck has an edge here.
Last question for you. Are we going to be able to see the trademark goat beard come pay-per-view April 14th?
No neck beard. I only could do it once. The girlfriend wouldn't kiss me, or rather, fiance wouldn't kiss me. So I was able to do it one time, but she said no more to that. She's a pretty good sport about everything else, so I figured just the one time would be good.
Well, maybe you should try to see if Bodog will allow, like, a fake goat's beard or something like that, you know? Just make a special case just for you because of your nickname.
We'll have to figure out something, you know. I might just start rocking a comb over. I've been seeing, I think that's a real good look for people. I've been looking around. I really like the comb over. I think I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, the comb over is always nice, too. Yeah, I agree. Well, Nick Thompson's going to be fighting Eddie Alvarez April 14th on the upcoming Bodog Fight pay-per-view. Nick, thanks for coming on the show, and best of luck on the 14th.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Live at the Mark of the Quad Cities, Moline, Illinois, Saturday, April 7th, 7:30 p.m., the International Fight League, the world's only mixed martial arts league, brings you explosive fighting action with championship-caliber athletes in its world premiere season. Be there as Pat Miletich's 2006 championship team, the Silverbacks, battles MMA legend Ken Shamrock's Lions, and kickboxing great Maurice Smith leads his Tiger Sharks against former Soviet Red Army Commando Igor Zinoviev and his team of Russian-born fighters, the Red Bear. Find out which team will reign supreme when five fighters from each team compete across five different weight classes in a full evening of non-stop fighting action. Get your tickets now at the Mark of the Quad Cities box office, Ticketmaster.com, or call Ticketmaster at 563-326-1111. Don't miss the chance to see the world's fastest growing sport Saturday, April 7th, 7:30 p.m. Check out IFL.TV for more details. It's mixed martial arts action like you've never seen.
Spencer the Kingfisher, and you listen to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Welcome to Full Contact Fighter Radio, and I am the co-host, Brendan Lear. The host of the show, we typically do this together, is, ironically, although he is an MMA writer, I believe functionally illiterate. And we had to read a book for this interview, so I got the nod, and I'm very happy to welcome Sam Sheridan, an author of A Fighter's Heart. Sam, welcome to the show.
Brendan, thank you very much, and maybe you could read it aloud to those who can't read.
Or
I will.
For my co-host, Kelsey, I would, in the form of charity, make him an audio book. Is there not an audio book yet?
I don't know anything about book publishing. Hopefully there will be someday, maybe, but hopefully they'll get somebody who actually has a nice voice to read it out loud and not me, because wouldn't be the right guy for it.
Charlton Heston.
Yeah, exactly. We'll get Charlton Heston. Thank you.
He did, like, the collected works of Aristotle, so...
This is right in there with that.
Exactly. It's right on my bookshelf.
If not better than
right next.
Collected works of Aristotle. Thank you for saying so.
I don't want you to be nervous. You know, you're just on The Daily Show, and, of course, this is a bit of a step up. Full Contact Fighter Radio, which is actually a podcast, so I just want you to relax a little bit.
Thank you. Well, I am nervous. I always get nervous. You know, it was a pretty interesting experience, the Daily Show thing. I was worried going into it because when I called them, they called me, whatever, for the pre-interview, I talked to this woman who, honestly, I spent 10 minutes trying to explain the difference between MMA and the UFC to her. And I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen in this interview? You know, like, she just refused to understand that there's a difference between the two. And so, I was very nervous that, you know, I didn't know what I was getting into, you know, with John, but he seemed like he was a cool guy and he was down, so it worked out fine. But it was, you know, the mainstream media dealing with MMA has been a sort of a weird experience.
Well, what did you expect really out of that show? I guess I always think about what Chomsky talks about when he talks about media concision. So basically, if you can't say what you want to say in 15 seconds, then there's no use saying anything because you just sound like a fool. So
that's a good, very good point. I mean, it's interesting because my agent and other people have been telling me, listen, you got to be like a politician. You got to get on message and stay on message and pick two or three things from the book that you want to hit. And I actually didn't do that very well on The Daily Show. I actually didn't think I did a very good job. But it was kind of nerve-wracking. But I went on Fox News for even less time, for 2 minutes, and I managed to get on message with that. You know, I had my little notebook, and I said, I'm going to say that fighting is about, you know, making yourself better. And I got that out, you know what I mean? So I've certainly been learning that. You really, you know, with these super short soundbite type things, you have to just pick one thing and hit it, and hopefully that gets out there enough.
Well, Kelsey will be very happy to hear that. Fox News is his favorite network, even though he doesn't actually get it in the States. I think he YouTubes it all day.
Right, him and Pat Miletich. Pat Miletich, he called me up and said, is the Communist Party going to revoke your membership now you've been on Fox News? I said, I hope they didn't see it.
So I want to get into your book a little bit, because I didn't know really what I was expecting when I picked it up. I thought it might be some sort of poetical waxing about fighting, but you actually went on what any fan of MMA would be considered to be a sort of ultimate fantasy camp almost.
Yeah, no, it's funny how it worked out. I mean, I just I was extremely lucky with the opportunities, and you know, I sort of got into it. The Muay Thai back in 2000, and the MMA stuff back in sort of 2003, and you know, it was still sort of off the radar for mainstream media. So these men's journal Winter Media guys were kind of like, oh, this is interesting. You know, we'd be interested in a book about this. So I said, oh well, I could write. You know, well, I'll give you a book about it if you want. And then. You know, what I could do at that point was I could go to my friends and the people I knew and say, you know, where would you go if you could go anywhere? And I could do a kind of an MMA fantasy or a fight fantasy kind of, you know, I had to get access, but I could consider lots of options and, you know, ask around and say, you know, if money wasn't a problem and you could go anywhere in the world to train for the next 4 months, where would you go? And, It was great, you know, it was super, super lucky.
So your first stop was at Fairtex in Thailand?
Yeah, I mean, that kind of existed on its own. You know, I did that for, not even to write about it, I did that just for fun. I was working on sailboats and just wanted to not sail. I had been working for a year and a half or so, I had money. I had boxed in college and I wanted to, you know, see what would happen if I went and lived somewhere and trained full time, and Fairtex was available. At the time, I think there was only a few places in Thailand that would take foreigners, and Fairtex was the big name, you know, expensive sort of place. But, you know, expensive being whatever it was, $150 a week or whatever for food and lodging and training. So, you know, I called them, I emailed the manager and said, can I come? And he said, sure. So I was in Australia, and I just flew, you know, it's a $70 plane ticket from Australia. So it worked out really well. But I never thought that the Fairtex experience was going to define my life the way it has, you know, just because I was like, oh, that was cool. You know, I'm too old. I was like 26. I'm like, I'm too old to be a pro fighter at this point. You know, I'm not that good. And, you know, there's not really an opportunity. But the story was good enough, and I had a pretty good perspective on it, everybody wanted to hear about it. And after a couple years, an agent came to me and said, you should really write that down, and I could sell it to men's magazines. And that's what really got the whole ball rolling.
It's amazing how many times you have those moments in your life when you think, oh, I'm just too old to do this or that. I remember in 92 when I first became interested in sort of MMA, and I lived in Alberta, and there was no place to train. I thought, who wants to be a black belt in this? Or you can go down, but it's way too late. I'm way too old, you know. And then all these moments where you think, shit, if I would have actually done that, I could have made something.
If I'd gotten on it. Yeah, no, that's how I feel. I mean, this last year, I sort of, man, if I could have gotten in the gym every day this last year, I could actually have a decent ground game by now. But I just haven't, you know, it's my own fault. Oh, I never get to it, you know what I mean? So.
So you start off that chapter with a Nietzsche quote. So I'm going to bust one out on you, and I want you to talk about this.
Bring it on.
He says, a few hours of mountain climbing turn a villain and a saint into two rather equal creatures. Exhaustion is the shortest way to equality and fraternity, and liberty is added eventually by sleep. And you said one of the things that you learn at Fairtex, apart from the Muay Thai technique, is that you need to be fit to win a fight, and that's the difference. If you're not fit, you lose, and if you're fit, you can overcome an opponent with better skills in light of your fitness. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, absolutely. I think especially with Muay Thai, what you would see over and over again was the guy in better shape, even if he has crappy technique, could make it out of the first and second rounds and start imposing his will. And we've all seen that 100 times with, you know, fighters destroying somebody for 2 rounds and then gassing and not being able to put him out, not being able to put the final touch on him and gassing out and getting beat. I mean, Rob Lawler and Mayhem Miller jumped to mind. Rob was, you know, basically raping Mayhem for 2 rounds, you know, and all over him. And you know, Robbie doesn't always get in the best shape, you know, and he gassed out and Mayhem took advantage of him. And if you watch the third round, Rob comes out and, you know, basically puts his hands up, you know, and just doesn't have the conditioning to continue. So,
The first time I ever read that, I didn't really understand what that quote meant. I didn't understand the implications.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I played football and rugby my whole life, when you get tired in those sports, you just sort of stop or you slow down.
Mm-hmm.
But there's something about fighting when you're in, when you're either grappling with someone or fighting with someone. When you get tired, the fight's still going on. So.
Yeah. Well, and also, yeah. I mean, it's sort of the other guy gets stronger. You know, you can. I mean, I think Pat Miletich has always talked about feeding off an opponent's getting tired, and he, you know, he's always been well conditioned in his fights. And I know that, like, you know, Roy Markham once told me he could look in a guy's eyes and see him break, and he kind of lived for that moment when he could really put it to his opponent and look in his eyes and watch him sort of acknowledge that defeat was coming some way or another. And, you know, so much of that is due to conditioning. You know, I've seen guys fight and you know, friends of mine have waved themselves out or taking a knee or whatever when, you know, if they could catch their breath for 15 seconds, they never would do that. You know, but they just, it seems impossible to continue when really it's, there's a, you know, the huge mental aspect. And also, you know, that's when you get into the real importance of looking like you're not tired, maintaining your breathing, you know, controlling your breathing, controlling your facial expression so you're not giving your opponent some kind of look that gives him hope. You know, if you can look like you're not tired. I mean, that's one thing that the boxing guys would always say to me was, you know, get your rest while you make him back up, you know, so throw fakes, look like you're coming forward, but use that time not to punch and to get your, you know, cut your anaerobic levels down, your oxygen, your CO2 levels down, get your oxygen levels back up, but don't look like you're resting and never appear, you know, and don't give the appearance of weakness, because, you know, that's a huge, I think it's a sort of an unspoken but very huge part of the game, which is the mental game you play, looking in someone's face and being aware of their mood and how they feel.
So is that something that, is that experience, it's almost a different form of knowledge. Either you've experienced that or you hadn't. And do you think that's the difference between the casual fans who say, oh, so-and-so's a pussy or so-and-so's got
right.
balls or whatever, and, you know, people who've never experienced that have that experience of utter exhaustion in the middle of a fight. You don't recognize, regardless of what your heart is or regardless of what, you know, whatever else is going on. If you're not there, if you can't cope, there's no way through sheer force of will you can just make yourself fight.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that's very hard to answer, you know, say, oh, those fans are full of shit, because, I'm sorry, can I swear on this or not?
What? Oh, yeah, sure.
Oh, okay.
If you can, then I can, so go ahead.
Okay, perfect. Well, I think, you know, it's very hard to say all those fans are just jerks. I mean, yes, I do have a big problem with fans criticizing fighters because they don't understand what they're going through or they're choosing to fight a certain way. I mean, I have a huge problem with the Boo Birds and, you know, the whole Tim Sylvia situation and Anderson Silva and things like that. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, I think it's true that you just never can tell what's going through someone's mind. And the more you have respect and understanding, which only comes through doing it. You can't really understand it. You can't claim to understand it unless you've at least tried it, I think, and done it. And I don't, you know, I haven't done it at anywhere near the level that I would need to be a really good commentator. But, you know, at least I can understand that I don't understand that, and I can work on my weaknesses, and I can ask the right people, you know, who, and you know, sometimes those people can't communicate effectively, and I can maybe communicate a little more clearly than they can. But so what I'm saying is that, you know, the respect is paramount. You know, there's nothing worse to me than critics who haven't done, you know, what they criticize. You know, people who criticize a book, you should have to have read a book, written your own book, if you're going to write a book review. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or if you're going to do a movie review, you should have had to have made a movie. So you understand just how insanely difficult the process can be and the kind of pressures that people are under and the way that things can change, from marketing to publication to this to that and the other thing. And, you know, with fighters, it's the same. I think you got to be really careful with your criticism, especially if you're just an armchair warrior, you know, because you have to recognize your understanding is pretty limited.
So what after you went and trained at Veritex, you pitched the idea for the book, and then you get to go on the real sort of fantasy tour. And
yeah.
You get to go train with Pat Miletich, and then Brazilian Top Team, and then of course in Oakland with Andre Ware, the Olympic medalist. So one of the things I wanted to ask you in your reflections, you very vividly describe all the different types of people you're with. One of the things that always struck me about MMA is that the original participants and some of the even the fans right now and some of the fighters you see aren't the typical fighters you would see, for instance, coming up in professional boxing. So it's not uncommon for, you know, someone in the suburbs to put mats down in their garage in the 90s and basically get a bunch of tapes, and then all of a sudden
right.
They're an MMA fighter.
Yeah.
Right? So these typical suburban kids who have more or less ordinary lives. And boxing seemed to have always been, you know, you see people, you know, coming up and saying, well, if I wasn't boxing, I'd be in jail or whatever. So what are your reflections about that on the different places that you've been? And of course, in Thailand, you had the same kind of observations that a specific type of person. You mentioned in the book somewhere that the Thais thought it was insane for some what do they call farangs? The white people would actually pay money to come endure this because this was almost a punitive thing for them.
Miserable, yeah. No, like you have to be have a screw loose to come over and live like an animal and get hit for a living. And I think, you know, when you talk about the differences, it's an interesting, a very interesting sort of conundrum. When you talk about professional fighting and MMA versus boxing, you, of course, you know, you talk about money and the professional apparatus, which in boxing and prize fighting is hundreds of years old and, you know, has like a very intact tradition and is also, you know, been much, much bigger than it is now. So you have kind of a faded glory to it. But, you know, there was this huge professional tradition that maybe peaked in the 20s and 30s during the Depression of people finding talent and training it and bringing it along. And for MMA, you don't really have that. And the money's not really there, even though, of course, now it's starting to be. So I think you'll see, you know, more as it becomes more professional, you'll start to see, and the purses get bigger, you'll start to see a more of a boxing mentality for the top MMA guys. So there's that difference, and I also think another big difference is that a lot of MMA fighters to this point, you know, have come out of martial arts, have come out of, you know, Taekwondo or whatever it was they did when they were kids. So there's more of a sense of kind of the intangibles of fighting and the mystique and the honor system and sort of a code that's bigger than what you've been just fighting. Whereas in boxing, you know, it doesn't have that at all. Boxing is about the bottom line and making money. So, those are some of the differences that I noticed.
Can you talk a little bit about the lack of goodwill when you're training in boxing? So you sparred, you had a fairly heavy sparring session and, you got hurt during that session, and typically if you're doing MMA or training in a gym or grappling, you know, someone would care that you got hurt, but it was almost that your sparring opponent was in callously indifferent to that.
Well, yeah, it's a colder kind of situation. You know, what's really interesting to me is that it it almost reflects back to this truism that I observed, where I think that boxing is actually much more ruthless and rough than MMA because of the limitations it has. You know, you really can't do anything in boxing but stand in front of the guy and punch him in the head or the stomach. And you, there's no other options. Well, obviously, you know all this, but I mean, it's so brutal in that sense that you just have to stand there and trade. You know, whereas MMA, there's this sort of beautiful, infinite variety of things you can do and ways you can think your way through a guy and set things up. And, you know, and if you're not, you know, if things aren't working out one way, you can try another way. And, you know, just because boxing has those big gloves doesn't mean the damage isn't there, obviously. I mean, all it does is, all those gloves do is, you just don't see the cuts, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It really reminds me of, this is a little bit off topic, but bullfighting for years, you know, that they would use horses, the picadors would ride horses, and the bulls would gore the horses as the picadors stabbed them in the back. And then they started wrapping, you know, it was too gory for the crowd, so they started wrapping the horses in this kind of canvas armor. And the horses would still die, but there wouldn't be blood everywhere. You know what I mean? So it's like, it's just, boxing is, you're just getting shelled just as bad. The force is all there, the concussive force.
Mm-hmm.
And the fatalities are there, of course, and the brain damage is there. But
that's almost a guaranteed. If you boxed for 20 years.
Yeah.
It's almost a guarantee that you're going to come out with some kind of limited mental capacity as a result of it.
I'll tell you right now though, the MMA guys of today are sparring enough that they're going to be in the same boat. That it's a fantasy that there won't be any brain damage in MMA because they're sparring. They're hard sparring. They're sparring with good guys,
mm-hmm.
and they're taking damage. You know, I do think it's safer. And it's much safer to get, you know, to obviously get stopped when you can't intelligently defend yourself is much safer. And, the little gloves, you know, they give you everybody a little bit more pop. So there's not the low impact of a jab or something. The punches are more significant, but it's a fantasy world if you think that guys aren't going to end up with brain damage.
Mm-hmm.
Or fatalities, you know, it's gonna happen. It's gonna happen. There's no question about it, you know.
And you describe in the book actually that that even though MMA fighters do box a lot, they train in boxing a lot. That MMA fighting is not boxing, and that that basically it's almost more like jousting on the feet because you go in for your hard shot and lead back out. You can't eat 10 shots coming in.
No, exactly. I've actually been having some really interesting discussions, and I'm going to probably write up a little piece for somebody on it. But I think there's some really interesting differences that you know, and some of them go back to the bare-fisted fighting, which if you look at the old bare-fisted prize fighters, they would only throw one or two punches a round. They wouldn't throw 60 punches a minute. You know what I mean? It was more two or three punches a minute. So the rate was a lot different. You have to be more careful because you cut quicker. And yeah, I mean, the takedown, of course, is the big one. You know, I mean, two or three takedowns can lose you a fight, obviously. So, I mean, you have to be super, if you don't want to get taken down, you have to be really respectful of coming in hard and, you know, the level change and all that stuff. So I think the striking game for MMA is inherently much different. And I think it's shown when pretty good boxers don't do, you know, get outstruck in MMA, and it happens fairly frequently and it's always a shock. But you know, it's because the game is different enough, you know.
The most recent Crazy Horse fight comes to mind.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's a great point. I didn't even think of that one, but I was thinking of Sakara and McFedries, you know.
Yes.
And there was that Pride guy, I forget who he was, what his name was. But he was like a cruiserweight, you know, boxing champ or something like that.
Yeah.
And he never got anywhere.
Cyborg would beat him in those.
Yeah, no, everybody would beat his ass because he never got anywhere because it's just a different kind of striking. You just can't get away with some of the things, you know. And I remember when Jens went and fought Gomi. I didn't know who Gomi really was at the time back in 04. I'd only seen him fight Half Gracie or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe, you know, Jens had 10 pro boxing fights and a bunch of knockouts, and I didn't think anybody could stand there with Jens.
Well, Gomi made his name on Jens and in that tournament that year, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and it's just a different game. Like, you couldn't, for a lot of reasons, you know, a lot of the defensive stuff that boxing is so great at it. And I love boxing, and I think it's beautiful, but a lot of it you just couldn't get away with. You couldn't fight like James Toney. You can't take shots on the top of your head and turn to take them on your shoulder. And you couldn't fight like Winky Wright because you don't have any gloves to catch on. You know, the fighting out of the pocket's a lot different. You can't take one to give one at all. You know, it's just not going to work. So anyway, there's a lot of interesting differences, I think.
Well, let's talk about your time at Brazilian Top Team. And you in the book, you actually met, I don't want to give away too much of the book. But you were injured for much of the time that you're there. But talk a little bit about that vibe. I thought it was very interesting because you talk about jiu-jitsu as a great equalizer in Brazil. And Brazil is a profoundly sort of class-based society. There's extremely rich people and extremely poor people. But you talk about the jiu-jitsu there as being an equalizing factor.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of the it wasn't like me making a brilliant insight. A lot of the jiu-jitsu guys will say that to you, and they're very proud of that, the idea that, you know, here on the mats, everybody's equal, that a street sweeper and a judge can roll together, and if the street sweeper wins, the judge has got to eat it, you know what I mean? Which in Brazil is an incredibly stratified society. There is, and it's hard to convey that to Americans. In the sense, but there really is an aristocracy and, you know, a tiny middle class and then a huge lower class. And the aristocracy, what's interesting about Brazil is that the aristocracy is where you get your MMA fighters and your jiu-jitsu guys, because there's no money in jiu-jitsu, and until very recently there wasn't, and they have the free time to train all the time. And the machismo code is everywhere in South America.
Talk a little bit about that. It was great. Now the term has escaped me. But what's the term for the
pitchy boy?
The pitchy boy.
Pitchy boys. Yeah. Pitchy boys. Like, it's a style thing. I mean, it's a social phenomenon in Rio, in Rio, and all the R's are H's, of course. So. And in Brazil in general, and the Pitchy Boy is this idea of these guys who are these kind of upper class guys, but they're all tatted up. They've been doing jiu-jitsu forever. Their ears are all cauliflowered, and they go around and they steal your girlfriend or beat you up in line to a party. You know, that's what they do. And like they party a lot, and they get in trouble with the police, but they always walk because they're rich and they can afford it. Because you know, there's not in Brazil there's if you're rich, you can't get in that much trouble with the law. So, it's not as big a story as it's been. It's been a huge story in the past, and some famous fighters have been, you know, involved in brawls that destroyed restaurants and things like that. But it is a fashion thing, which is interesting, that some guys, you know, that it's like, some guys will dress like it, even if they're not jiu-jitsu guys. And, you know, poor street kids will often mash up their ears with rocks so they look like they do jiu-jitsu, so people will leave them alone.
Right. It's kind of interesting for people in the know, you know, if you have a choice to mess with a dude with cauliflower ears or not, it's probably just as better not.
Absolutely. No, it's a little warning sign, you know what I mean? It's one of those things you might check out. You look at it was funny for me walking around, at some of these events in Brazil, the small, smaller events, MMA events, you know, just because I don't look like a fighter, I don't have the build. I mean, also because of the prevalence of steroids, everybody's huge, you know what I mean? So guys are gigantic, and they're all pitchy boyed up, they're all cauliflower, and I don't have cauliflower ears, so people look, you know, they just dismiss you right away if you don't look that way. And another funny thing is they call their girlfriends, Maria Tatami, you know, like Maria the Mat. If you're a Pitchy Boy's girlfriend. So yeah, it's rough. I mean, it's a rough kind of thing. And, you know, they've been known to pull down a tent on a party they didn't like. And, But, you know, I think it's probably overhyped, and one of those things.
So they're kind of like the jocks in 1980s John Hughes movies.
Exactly. Yeah. No, totally. And like, you know, there's other, you know, like the mods in Canada at one point, weren't they like a gang or something? And, you know, there's like a, there's a fashion sense to the Moto Boys who all had to have those, super bikes, you know, and you know, it's to some extent, it does exist, but it's some, you know, it's not like it's a huge ubiquitous problem or something like that.
Talk a little bit about the jiu-jitsu culture and the surf culture and the marijuana culture, because it was very, you made some very interesting observations about how all those things sort of just go intimately together in Rio.
Yeah, I mean, I think because of the way Rio is, which is, you know, it's a beautiful place with great surf, and it's the home of Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So you know, all the guys are doing it are young, strong. Not all of them, but you know, there's this young, athletic guy. He's obviously going to surf, and you know, the marijuana thing comes into that very naturally into the beach culture and into the party culture, and a lot of guys, you know, think it helps their jiu-jitsu. You know, a lot of guys think because it, you know, lets them think in new ways and relax. And you know, I think a lot of high-level jiu-jitsu is about letting the position come and being relaxed and looking for new ways out of old problems. And if you're sufficiently open-minded, you can find all kinds of new stuff. And I think, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole argument about, you know, marijuana and if it's bad for you or not. But I certainly don't think it's a performance-enhancing drug, and I don't think the Nevada State Commission should test for it, you know.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to follow up with. I take it, well, there'd be different attitudes, and as, I guess the attitudes may be just cultural. I take it you didn't, you know, light up a spliff before you went and trained at Militich.
No, well, that's certainly true. But, you know, for me personally, I don't think it would help my game. I would get all paranoid and freak out, so I would probably just cling to someone in as tight a guard as I could and get crushed.
Was it surprising to you that guys like Nick Diaz, you know, came back positive?
Not at all. No, it's not surprising.
Now supposedly Diego Sanchez was positive as well.
It doesn't surprise me the slightest. I mean, I think, you know, I don't think it's a big problem. I mean, there's a certain kind of guy that you know, that can work, that loves to work out on it, you know, come on, man. You know, like, who cares, really? You know what I mean? It's like, drinking is worse. We all know, everybody knows that. The science is all there. I mean, it's just not the cultural of the Western culture. So, like I said, I don't want to get into that, you know, a huge discussion about marijuana, but it doesn't bother me. You know what I mean? And I'm not surprised that these guys use it. And a lot of top-level jiu-jitsu guys do like it. You know what I mean? And do enjoy it. And I think, you know, my take on it is that, you know, you gotta have an open mind about pretty much everything.
A person who gets punched in the face for a living doesn't know what fear is. Pain doesn't exist if you train more than 30 hours a week. Someone who fights with broken bones has a totally different definition of agony. Bodog Fight mixed martial artists know that fear, pain, and agony won't last. But the glory of having your hand raised at the end of the fight, that lasts forever. Bodog Fight, St. Petersburg. Don't miss any mixed martial arts action. Check your local listings or visit BodogFights.com for details.
Welcome back to Full Contact Fighter Radio. And the big news today, Brendan, are the results from last night's Icon card in Hawaii. And you stayed up and watched the fights. I unfortunately pussied out and didn't. But, and I haven't had a chance to see them yet. I'd like to see those fights. Sounds like it was a great fight for going into the fourth round. What was your thoughts on the whole Trigg Lawler fight, Brendan?
Yeah, it was a fantastic fight. As sleepy as I was at the time, I had to take this opportunity this weekend to catch up on a lot of missed MMA television. So, apart from the fact that I've convinced myself now that my choice not to become a commodities trader and having to wake up to the Japanese market every morning was a wise one, because I was freaking tired.
Yeah.
But, no, the fight itself was certainly a payoff for staying up that late, because it was an absolute war. And, it was a real nice back and forth. Lawler had knocked Trigg on his ass a couple times, a number of times during the fight. It was nice back and forth. And foundations working. And when Lawler had Trigg in trouble, especially the knockout was spectacular and vicious at the same time, because I think Trigg was basically knocked out with the first punch, and then three not grazing blows, but subsequent punches that may have reawakened him and subsequently knocked him out yet again. He was a brutal, vicious knockout, and he went down for the count, that's for sure. And I actually haven't heard today. I know he went to hospital after that, but that's the last word we have. I haven't had confirmation that he's okay.
I'm sure. I mean, I haven't seen confirmation that he's okay, but I would assume that he probably is if we haven't seen a report. But, Nick Thompson alluded to it as well, and I think he kind of shared my predictions. I didn't necessarily think that Frank Trigg was going to walk through Robbie Lawler, but I mean, you look at, he beat Jason Miller, the guy who beat Robbie Lawler. He looked great against Misaki. So I think a lot of people, Brendan, were probably picking Frank Trigg to win this fight.
I thought Trigg was on a little bit of a tear myself, but actually I listened to two interviews that he did before the fight, and I think Trigg, and as much as I hate poker, I'll use the new phenomenon of poker, I'll use the phrase, he's got this tell, and he came off sounding like such an arrogant bastard during the interviews, but I think he's kind of like that when he's not very confident. And, he didn't actually pull it out. And I think Trigg, I'm not sure if he was ready to go four, but after two, his hands were way down, and he didn't look gassed. He wasn't huffing and puffing through his mouth, but he was getting, just lost that crisp edge that I think you need for someone as dangerous as Lawler on his feet. And the same being said, Lawler was seemed crisp, a little crisper in the third and fourth, which is surprising for him because we know him to be to undertrain, especially in cardio for fights. So that was the big difference, I think.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where Lawler goes from here. Obviously, he's a very well-known fighter in Hawaii, and I mean, that's such a great fight state that there'll always be big fights in Hawaii. And, a guy could have a pretty successful career, I think, on its own, just fighting in Hawaii.
Well, both of them are in interesting situations because Trigg works for Pride, and he has fought in Pride, and Lawler fought in Pride and is fighting for Icon, but now Icon has sided on the other side of the Pride in the UFC scenario. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to him, where he ends up.
Yeah. And Jason Miller, he pulled out the victory. How did he look, Brendan?
He looked good. I think it was a pretty... I think he was set up... his victory was set up to be sort of a foregone conclusion in everyone's mind, and he actually had a knockout, so kudos to him. Sure, maybe some Sean Tompkins is...
Terry, so could you, yeah?
So could you. Judo Terry has rubbed off on him.
Renito Verissimo getting back on the winning track as well. He's had some tough luck in the last couple of years. How did he look?
He looked good. He kind of looks like he's reinvigorated a little bit, I think. I think after he got screwed out of that decision against Matt Hughes... I think he kind of lost a little bit of his edge, but I think he's one of these guys who's if he dedicates himself to MMA, he's kind of like he's obviously a jiu-jitsu wizard, but I think he dedicates himself to MMA, maybe he sees a reasonable payday in it, so maybe it's a job to him now that he's refocused and committed to.
Yeah, I'd like to talk more about the card and get more insights on it, but the Sheridan interview was pretty long, and as well as Nick Thompson, so we don't have a ton of time.
Well, I had to do it like Peter Jackson did Lord of the Rings, right?
Right.
Kind of do two interviews simultaneously at the same time to save money.
Well,
don't you think that was pretty ambitious in my interview debut, my solo interview debut?
Yeah, that was very crafty of you.
Next one's going to be a trilogy.
You've always been a crafty guy. Let's get into Ultimate Fight Night this Thursday. There's so much going on. We talked about that in the beginning of the show. It's a crazy busy month. I don't know if we'll have a show up before Thursday, so let's break it down right now. And then, of course, there's the UFC 69 on Saturday. A couple fights on the undercard I want to talk about. The first one, Seth Petruzzelli versus Wilson Gouveia. This could be a pretty entertaining light heavyweight matchup, actually. Your thoughts on this fight, Brendan?
I got to go with the Wilson here. I liked his last fight. I think he did very well. He looks good. I think he's. I think he'll take it.
Kata Nakamura versus Drew Fickett, a good welterweight matchup.
This is tougher. Thicket's kind of coming back in this one, and he's coming back against a rough, tough guy. So I think if he doesn't dominate the fight early, Nakamura could wear him down and take him out. So I'm going to go out on the ledge and pick Nakamura in this one.
Really? Interesting. Yeah, I forgot to make my pick with Petruzzelli. I'm going to end Gouveia. I'll probably go with Gouveia as well. You know, Petruzzelli is one of those guys that he hasn't fought in the UFC, I don't think, in a little bit now, and it's hard. Sometimes he's looked really great in his career, and then sometimes not so much. But Gouveia's got a lot of tools. He looks pretty good standing. He's good on the ground. So I think I'm going to go with Gouveia on that one. But that's a really hard fight to call. And then Drew Fickett versus Keita Nakamura. I don't know a ton about Nakamura. I haven't seen him fight a lot. I think Drew Fickett looked really impressive against Carol Parisi. And, you know, that was a great fight. And he almost had to feel sorry for the guy in the sense that he put on that good of a performance and not come away with a win. But I'm going to go with Fickett in that fight.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I think it'll be tough. I think if he has the same kind of gas against that he did against Parisian, too, I think he's got a good shot. But I'm going to go with my intuition, my gut on this one.
And the next fight, Dakota Shigusuka Mishima versus Kenny Florian. We had Kenny on the program. Mishima's a guy that I think a lot of people are hardcore MMA fans have seen fight in Pride a few times and in his UFC debut against Joe Stevenson. I think that this fight's going to be a lot more competitive than people think. He's a good fighter. He's tough. Not that Florian's overlooking him at all. You could tell that when we had him on the show, he's certainly taking this fight very seriously. This one, I think it's a close fight. I think I'm going to go with Florian, but I wouldn't want to bet on this fight.
Yeah, I think one of the things, it could work two ways. The American fighters tend to be far more conservative, I find, especially MMA fighters, very apprehensive to give up dominant position for a submission, and far less laissez-faire than Japanese fighters. Mishima is exactly that. If anything, he is almost, I don't want to say laissez-faire, if anything, he's almost... fights haphazardly and is very unconventional on the ground and is willing to give up and does actually seemingly for no good reason give up good positions to go for something. So if you can deal with that, if you can cope with that, that's great. And I think Florian's a fairly composed fighter and I think he will be able to cope with that. But if you can't, I think that kind of style can really throw you off and you end up getting caught in things. So yeah, I think I gotta go with Florian just because I think he's gonna have his head about him.
And then the main event, Joe Stevenson versus Melvin Guillard, and then this fight has gotten really nasty in the pre-fight rhetoric. I got to admit, as an MMA writer, that's not an area of the sport that I love delving into. I think some people, and I understand that it makes for good reading, and a lot of people like hearing about the drama and the soap operas that can go on with insults and the pre-fight banter, etc. I don't really know a lot about this situation other than the fact there's been a few accusations thrown Stevenson's way from Melvin Guillard. Do you know a little bit about it, Brendan? Did you read up on some of these accusations that have been flying back and forth between the two?
I actually heard their interview that they were on together on MMA Weekly, and I heard that. And I don't know. It was kind of anticlimactic. I think the guys at MMA Weekly were hoping that it would blow up into a sort of Diaz Riggs thing, but it really didn't.
Oh, so they were on simultaneously.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it was trying. They were trying to get like a kind of the View thing going.
Right.
With Damien, I guess, who would Damien be? He would be Meredith.
So they're sort of backpedaling from it a little bit. There wasn't as much.
Well, I think Guillard said that Stevenson. He heard that Stevenson was on growth hormone, and I don't know, just a wild accusation.
Yeah.
And yeah. You and I being men who aren't much into gossiping, I don't know, I don't relate to those things too much.
Right. Well, let's get into the action. Let's talk about what really matters then, the fight itself. This fight we've been talking about for a long time since it's been announced that we both thought it was going to be really, could be really entertaining. Who are you picking in this fight, Brendan?
You know, I think I got to go with Stevenson just because I think Guillard's not ready. I think he is... They needed to pump him a little bit more, and I think Stevenson is just the fight that he didn't need. I think he's so proficient on the ground, and if he's in good shape, I think he can take Guillard down and neutralize his neutralizes striking. So, yeah, I got to go with Stevenson. I don't think Guillard's ready for him just yet. That nothing. I don't want to take anything away from Melvin, but I think he's. I just don't think this is the fight that he needed at this time.
I'm gonna.
And apparently, he's been beating up Rich Clemente when he sees him as well, like on the street. So, this is something he seems to not really have his head focused in the right direction.
What? I didn't even hear about this.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I gotta surf the internet more, I guess.
Yeah, you gotta. Tap into that MMA MMA stream on the internet.
Yeah, I gotta stop actually just looking for confirmations and facts. And
Kelsey, forget about the facts.
Right.
You gotta chase the dream.
Dig
in the dirt. The facts are much higher level than the dirt.
Right. No, I agree with your breakdown of the fight a lot. Most of what you had to say. I think that Stevenson probably will get the win. I think his takedowns are solid. I think if he gets him to the ground, he'll get a ground-and-pound victory or maybe a submission. In saying that, though, I think it's more than evident in Melvin Guillard's background that he can knock you out with one punch. He's shown that. So, he's got a great chance. He's very athletic, and he seems to be really, really strong. So, I think he's got a chance at beating Joe. The one thing is that if he does get the big highlight reel knockout over Joe Stevenson, then immediately he's going to be catapulted right up the rankings in the UFC. And then if he loses, though, it's kind of a win-win for the UFC, because if he wins, you're right. I mean, most people will just look at it as that he still has a ways to go and has to work on some other elements of his game, and he's still got a bright future. So it's kind of a win-win for Melvin Guillard, I think.
Yeah, I think the pressure's on Stevenson, actually, in this fight, to be quite honest, because I think a lot of people are expecting him to beat Guillard, and if he doesn't, then I think, if Melvin loses this fight, he's always a flashy fighter. He's got lots of, he's got almost unlimited potential. But I think, just in terms of marketing, in terms of someone who you're going to want to watch or you're going to like to watch fight because he's really flashy. But if Stevenson doesn't pull it off, I don't know. I think it'll look bad for him.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Joe Stevenson is one of those names that's always brought up when people discuss who might have a shot at beating Sean Sherk. Of course, Hermes Franca. Joe Stevenson is one of those guys, and I think a lot of people expect him to do well and to be a future title contender. So I agree with you that there's a lot of pressure probably riding on his shoulders. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But Brendan, on that note, we got to get out of here. The show's getting quite long in the tooth, so we'll talk to you later in the week, and we'll break down UFC 69.
All right, take it easy.